This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Sigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 18th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm very pleased to have with me today Eugene Spafford. Hi, Spaff.
Hello, Gary.
Eugene Spafford, or Spaff as everybody calls him, is a professor of computer science and ECE at Purdue. He's also the executive director of Sirius. Spaff is widely published in the academic literature, and his PhD is from Georgia Tech. Spaff's also an IEEE fellow and has received numerous awards for his work, including the Computer Society Technical Achievement Award. Spaff also works to inject security reality into the commercial space, most notably through his work with Tripwire and his books. He wrote Practical Unix and Internet Security. So let's get started. Some of your really early academic work was on software testing. In particular, I'm thinking about Mothra and your mutation testing work. Believe it or not, I've actually read that stuff. And then you moved into security, and now security seems to be kind of catching on to testing. So what role do you think software testing plays in computer security?
Well, I think it plays an important role, especially if you look at testing as a very broad concept, more than simply just testing the code, but also testing its performance in relating to other artifacts and testing user interface perceptions and so on. We use a lot of software that isn't developed carefully, and the tools and techniques and languages that we are using are not necessarily the best for producing high-quality, robust software. So testing is a way for us to attempt to reduce, at least, some of the problems that may occur with it. And it's a mechanism that's fairly well understood by people. So I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon. I think it does play an important role, especially when we start talking about porting software to new environments or new user populations.
It sort of strikes me that testing, when considered from the, say, software reliability or quality perspective, has a ton to teach security, just about how one might build an assurance case and what kind of testing is actually effective. Because the first generation of, say, these web application security tools, which are just basic black box testing things, are pretty silly from a testing perspective. Do you think that security is beginning to understand that there's a real, you know, academic underpinning for testing at all?
There's not a really simple answer to that, unfortunately, because we have such a broad scope of development activity. We have people, for instance, who really do understand security and who use more formal development methods with well-designed specifications and tools, particularly if they're building embedded software or they're building for some but not all, especially dedicated security applications or defense applications. Mm-hmm. To the other end of the spectrum, where we have code that's put together by people who don't have much training in security or really in software engineering for that matter, where they throw things together, it evolves over time, it has lots of patches, and they're still somewhat blissfully unaware of good techniques to use. So the challenge with testing there is in building testing software that can work on artifacts that may not have well-stated specifications. Mm-hmm. And used by people who may not have a lot of familiarity with good testing technologies. But also, the testing community has traditionally developed testing against specifications to make sure that programs do what they're designed to do. And in the security realm, what we want to test is make sure that it doesn't do anything beyond what it's designed to do.
Exactly, yep.
And so that's a new area where much of the testing that goes on now has sort of ad hoc tests for instance, buffer overflows.
Yeah, or maybe just fuzz testing.
Simple fuzz testing to to see if it gets an unexpected behavior for input that wasn't part of the specification. And that really is very immature technology overall. So I think we have a long way to go both on the testing and on the development.
Yeah, that's a good answer. I believe that software security is, to some extent, a sexy subset of software behavior. You know, thinking about quality and reliability and some of the other abilities. Do you think that we're making progress on the software behavior front?
Well, some. I actually think that security has more to it than that, because we also have to look at human behavior and setting policy aspects. There are also issues of after the fact investigation that fit
forensics.
In and privacy. But that's part of the issue, is that we really don't have a good definition for boundaries. It's not clear that we need the boundaries, although for those of us who are doing the research, developing the tools, and teaching the practitioners, it's helpful to know how much we should be including. But the field is still developing, and we're still learning that.
So computer security has changed plenty since the days of the Morris worm. And in many ways, it's a lot more commercial than it used to be way back then. And I wondered, you know, as an academic, what role you thought commercial certifications have to play in computer security, and whether or not those certifications replace or in any way obviate academic training.
This again goes, I think, to the issue of what's the scope of the field. And if we look at some of the certifications that are out there, there's two broad categories. There are the training certifications and the educational certifications, if you will, the professional certifications.
Mm-hmm.
The training certifications are the ones that are offered by vendors and some of the specialized security training institutes, even by law enforcement agencies for those who are doing forensic investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And basically those training certificates say that those individuals have been exposed to certain tools and technologies and know how to apply them to a given situation.
That's when you're being generous sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes they say you had $400 and you don't have it anymore.
That's right. I mean, we know of cases certainly where 110% of everybody who pays this the fee gets the certificate kind of situation. There are other kinds of certifications, and I would say that some academic degrees fall in this category as well, where hopefully the content is structured so that someone who gets through and masters it can be said to actually understand some of the deeper relationships of the concepts and is able to apply them in new situations that they haven't seen before, and to take the abstractions and apply them to new tools and new problem sets. There aren't a lot of those out there, but there are some. And some of the more advanced security management and auditing certifications seem to cover some of that territory.
Mm-hmm.
Again, as a really fast-evolving field, it's difficult to say what's fundamental and what isn't.
Right.
That people should be trained up on. And at one point, talking about programming flaws in Fortran and COBOL may have been central. And now, not really quite so much.
Right. So it seems that there are kind of two major clumps of security people in the world. There are practitioners who are focused on operations, like the people who have to administer and set up and run all of the security apparatus, including firewalls and antivirus stuff. And then there are security engineers, and it's not clear that they should really have the same sorts of certifications or background, frankly.
That's correct. I don't know whether under operational personnel you're also including the people who perform the audits for compliance and who do the investigations.
Well, that's a really good question, actually. You know, where do those people fall, in your opinion?
I sort of actually see that as a third area of emerging specialization.
Interesting.
That those individuals need to understand how the systems are constructed and interact, but don't necessarily need to have all the skills to build the systems themselves. And they need to understand how those systems are supposed to be configured and behave, but don't necessarily need to know everything involved in running them.
Right.
In addition, however, when you have people who are doing compliance auditing and investigations for law enforcement or defense purposes, they need to have additional information about motives, about laws, regulations, and so on. So that really does seem to me to be an area that has emerged and is continuing to evolve as a third area.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty interesting watching this field change. You've participated in gazillions of blue ribbon panels. I'm thinking of things like PTAC or the Grand Challenges work. What happens with those reports once they're done?
Well, that's an issue that is frustrating for some of us who are on those groups. We're trying to come up with agendas that people can rally behind to make a difference. And it is very difficult because policymakers and people who control budgets don't seem to fully grasp both the magnitude of the problem that is building and the fact that they can't put all the funding and effort in at the back end when a problem occurs and fix it quickly.
Right.
So, for instance, the PTAC report, when that came out, that was presented to the Executive Office of the President, and then members of the committee went out and briefed officials associated with Congress, for instance, and some executive agencies, some press briefings and so on, trying to build a certain level of awareness and concern that might translate into development of some programs.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it didn't. It generated some interest from a few places, but nobody in a position to actually affect policy really seemed to get it. And I don't know whether that's because they just didn't see it as a serious enough problem, or maybe they thought it was not as pressing as other problems.
Right. But certainly the government has had a hard time, you know, getting their arms around cybersecurity and taking it seriously. If you look at, say, what's gone on in DHS, for example.
It certainly has not been handled well, and if you currently look at some of the issues that are involved, there are almost 24 agencies across government that have some role to play in this arena. They can't agree on where the lines of demarcation are between them, or who should be coordinating the efforts, or even necessarily who should be making the investments. And of course, that hinders our development of defenses. And as more systems get put into play, they're being put into play with weaknesses inherent in them.
Do you think that the recent information warfare stories, like the Russia script kiddies Estonia, or the Chinese hackers get into the Pentagon network, will help any just because they're high-profile stories?
I have mixed feelings on this, in part because we don't really know exactly the magnitude, what's going on underneath the surface, what's really going on, and therefore what kind of threat picture this really poses for our various leaders. I think the trend, however, that is emerging with those, as well as cybercrime in general, should be raising some warning bells in government. and that's because those are more economically motivated. And so certainly we are familiar with the kinds of break-ins now that are occurring a lot on commercial systems, phishing, credit card fraud, identity theft, and so on for consumers. Those are all obvious identity frauds. But what we're seeing as financial frauds, more organized crime, certainly that is attacking financial systems, for instance, committing fraud on a large scale for business fraud and financial fraud.
Mm-hmm. And phishing plays a huge role in that.
It does, although some of the targets that I'm thinking of are actually attacks on interbank transfers, for instance, or large-scale counterfeiting or theft, draining of accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Money laundering is another big problem in support of other kinds of criminal activity, such as narcotics trafficking or illegal gambling and moving the money from place to place.
Yeah, you know those online games, which I've been working on lately, are great ways to launder money.
Oh, those those, yes, those provide an amazing way for somebody who wants to transfer. But there's a third category, and you had mentioned some of the stories that are appearing about nation-state kind of activities. And if you look at those have a very significant economic component. So the Estonia incidents shut down the banks and the commerce in the country for, in some cases, weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Huge financial hit on the country. Some of the other things that we're seeing where nation states are being accused of espionage, it used to be 20 years ago that they were simply after military information.
Mm-hmm.
But now, in today's world, and this is perhaps why we don't see some of the urgency of some officials, the idea of an all-out world war against some of these countries is just inconceivable because our economies are so interlinked. But from a nation-state perspective, coming in and stealing trade secret information, stealing competitive advantage, sabotaging competitors for national industries, amount to huge differences for state-owned industries or large-scale companies that have a national interest. And that appears to be one of the motives, emerging from the stories at least that I've seen in the press, for why some of this is occurring. And we know some countries have publicly declared that their state intelligence services are devoted to providing economic advantage to national industries.
Right, right. So that changes the threat profile pretty significantly.
It does. It's something that, instead of being necessarily a military problem, is still a national security problem, but it's also a huge economic problem that we're all facing.
So I want to change gears just a little bit. You recently brought up the old reformed hackers thing on your blog, and I agree with your basic opinion, but I wonder about the critical role that real exploit discussion plays in security. Now, if designers and developers need to deeply understand exploits in order to avoid building broken systems, and yet people who do this illegally are criminals and we don't want to talk to them, how do you balance out those kind of two opposing things? Or are they not really opposing?
I don't think they're really opposing. And I believe that a lot of what's talked about as ethical hacking is a little bit overdone, in part because we failed to build the systems properly in the first place.
Right.
How many times do you actually have to do buffer overflow to understand how it works?
Apparently more than we've done so far.
Yeah, well, certainly there's no reason for somebody to make a career to continually be building toolkits and exploiting buffer overflows.
Right.
The fact that we haven't gone back and fixed the basic processes that cause these to occur is really the problem itself.
Yeah, I agree with that, as you know.
So as long as we're faced with some of these badly constructed artifacts, then maybe that is a form of self-defense, is to make sure that some of the common problems aren't present. But I think too much weight is given to it as a matter of how are we going to understand security, because understanding how to break something doesn't necessarily show you how to fix it.
Sure. Well, it's just that you're testing conundrum. If you break something through kind of blind, crazy black box testing or obvious testing, then you know that it's bad. But if you don't break it through the same sort of obvious black box testing, that doesn't mean that it's good. So
right.
You end up with a badnessometer. That's what I call those things.
Exactly. Well, it's also the case that if you break it, that doesn't provide a fix necessarily.
Exactly, yep.
And one of the problems that I have been seeing recently because of some of the work I've been doing with large businesses and government agencies, they are simply getting hammered by the people who are publishing the exploits to the problems they find without really giving thought to the consequences.
Right, right.
Most,
so you have to do that very carefully.
Yeah. Well, most aren't.
Yeah.
Because most of the people who are publishing the exploits, you've got two or three people working in a back room, and their total experience is with a couple PCs running Linux or Windows on the desktop.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're looking at an agency like a large bank or the U.S. Air Force, they're running tens of thousands of machines using legacy applications in critical day-to-day environments. They can't roll out a patch even as fast as what a vendor puts in place. Mm-hmm. They're stuck. Mm-hmm. And so what's happening is they're being endangered on a regular basis by these people who are supposedly showing all of us where the problems are and how to fix them. Mm-hmm. And so this whole idea of breaking systems as a way of protecting them really has a number of flaws to it, and those are just a couple of them.
Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, we do really need to talk about exploits and how they really work, not necessarily to out vendors or to get people in operational trouble, but just to understand the nature of real exploits. You know, for example, your internet worm story is one of those, where the idea was to explain technically what really happened so that we can try to avoid that in the future.
Exactly. And we do need to do that. We do need to document. But more than that, simply than publishing exploits or particular patches, and this is where the research aspect comes in, and the responsible part is stepping back and saying, well, where did the processes go wrong so another buffer overflow got into place?
Exactly, yeah.
Or what's a generic construct that we can use to avoid these in the future, such as, for instance, getting away from the C language family.
Sure.
And use something else.
Yeah, that's what got me interested in software security back in the Java security days, because we kept breaking the VM and breaking the VM, and I was thinking to myself, why is it that these amazingly great engineers screwed this up? And if you wanted not to, where would you go to figure it out?
I actually believe that part of this has to do with just the nature of how we think about our field in general, where we talk about computer science and engineering. Mm-hmm. And we have many people who view it as a scientific pursuit where there is a correct approach. And in fact, many are trained to have the attitude that if they go in and use the mechanisms they've been taught, what they'll produce is a correct artifact. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it is an engineering approach where, because of factors that we don't think about, because of flaws in some of the tools we use and mistakes of the people involved, there are going to be flaws. And we haven't built the artifacts with that assumption in mind.
Right. So we got to revisit those basic assumptions.
We really do, I think, have to revisit our whole attitude of how we build systems to build compensation, correction, and detection into them as we go along.
Mm-hmm. So stepping into the Wayback Machine, when I was a Usenet reader in 88 and 89 and a netizen, I remember the Yux Digest that you used to do. What became of the Yux Digest?
It's still there, but it actually split into two. The Yux Digest actually continues to be published. I think I'm in like the 21st year, but very rarely, because most of the humor that you find now is in other places. And there's a mailing list where people send me, and I occasionally stumble across really weird websites that I send out URLs, but
yeah,
those are very low-volume lists.
So do you think that modern social networks like MySpace and Facebook in any way replace the early Usenet news groups or not?
I think they're manifestations of the same basic idea, which is to share things that we find interesting with like-minded individuals. So whether they're mailing lists, news groups, back in, again, going way back, things like MUDs and BBS systems. Instead of MUDs, now we've got Second Life.
Right. Well, actually, instead of MUDs, now we have World of Warcraft.
Yeah. And who knows what we'll have next. But I don't see those being significantly different from each other.
There are just a hell of a lot more people involved in doing it. I mean,
many
you know, back in the Usenet days, that you probably could actually count all the number of net users. Now, I don't know if you could.
Just probably
very,
not.
Very large number and people hopping on and off so often. One last question, which is completely off topic, but who has influenced your career the most?
Oh, gosh. I don't think I could either pin the blame or the credit on any individual, because there are so many. My interest really, looking back and even looking forward, don't fit in any one particular niche that somebody has had.
Yeah, I hear you.
So I recently talking with a couple of friends of mine, my father passed away this summer, and I was thinking one of the things that he and my mother both greatly impressed on me was that whatever I did with science and technology, I would keep in mind that people were at the other end, mm-hmm. and that the one thing that I couldn't create for myself that other people had to bestow is respect and trust. Well, that's two things that they have to bestow. That those are not things you can manufacture. And so those have guided me a lot in some of the things I've done generically. If you look at the technology, I've picked up bits and pieces in software engineering from a variety of people, mm-hmm. In security from a variety of people. I think two people that I regularly, well, three that I really think of as having set examples for me, Peter Neumann, mm-hmm. Has both in security and in reliability.
A past Silver Bullet victim, by the way.
Yep, and great interview, and just a wonderful thinker who's done so much for the field. Somebody in security from the business side who has impressed a lot of thinking about the business processes, William Hugh Murray, mm-hmm. And I don't know how many people in the academic side are familiar with his work,
right.
And Peter Denning.
Yep.
Many of the things that he wrote and did and talking about the nature of the profession have had a big influence.
Well, the closest is we got to Peter in Silver Bullet is his wife.
Well, that's
also a previous victim of Silver Bullet.
The 6 degrees there.
There you go. Well, thanks a lot. This has been fun, Spaff.
Thank you, Gary.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine, where excerpts are published in every issue. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.